This week on Writers, Inc.
One of the important things that authors need to know is that editors at publishing houses get so many submissions. Doesn't matter if they're fiction or nonfiction or both, they are getting so many, I mean, hundreds and hundreds a year for many of these editors. You start to get a sense of how low the rate is, right? And that's the space you're fighting for.
J.K. Rowling was nearly homeless when she wrote the first Harry Potter book. Stephen King penned Carrie in a small desk wedged between a washer and dryer. James Patterson worked in advertising and famously crafted the Toys R Us theme song long before becoming an author. Join New York Times bestseller J.D. Barker and a panel of industry powerhouses as they pull back the curtain on some of the world's most prolific authors. Where did they start? What is their process? The biggest names in publishing all have origin stories, all have tips and secrets. What does it take to consistently top the bestseller lists and become a household name? Get your notepad out. School's in session. This is Writers, Inc.
Hi, I'm Christine Daigle.
I'm Jenna Brown.
A.P. Reinflesh.
I'm Kevin Tomlinson, spelled with a C.
What?
Because I wanted you to fit in, Christine.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate you.
Whatever spells Kevin with a C. Like, you see, like, Caitlin can be K and C.
I never see anybody spell it any other way. Although, I get asked all... Well, okay, if I go to, like, a Starbucks or something and they ask my name, there's a 50-50 chance they're going to spell it with a Y, which I think is...
Really?
...remarkable. I've never encountered anybody who spelled their name that way.
No, I don't think I've... So, K-E-V-Y-N?
Yeah.
Fascinating.
Yeah. Get in touch with the younger generation. Come on, you.
Yeah, that's what it is. That's why I'm not hip.
If someone wants to name their baby, they should name it Kevin, C-E-V-Y-N.
Yeah.
I think.
Great.
Yeah. You know, JP, you write Cozy Fantasy. That seems like a Cozy Fantasy
name.
We
need a Kevin.
That would totally be.
Sure.
Yeah, I could see.
I'll write that one down. Thanks, yeah. Jenna. I'll attribute you in the acknowledgments.
I'd better show up in some kind of acknowledgments or author's note or something, though.
Yep. Oh. This is definitely going to happen.
Oh, my gosh.
I have doubts of the sincerity in your voice, but that's okay. You know what? Anyone listening, if you feel a kinship with Kevin with a C and a Y.
There you go.
Yeah, we want to know about
it. I would love to hear alternative spellings to Kevin. I would love to hear that. That would be a good 5-second conversation.
Oh, well, JD is not here, so I guess I better ask. Kevin, what's in the news?
Kevin with a C and a Y, what's in the news? Well, Smashwords Store simplifies royalty rates. The Smashwords Store is updating its royalty rates effective January 1st, 2026. Books priced under $2.99 will earn 40% list. Books priced $2.99 and higher will earn 75% list, the highest among all major ebook retailers. The Smashwords Store paid royalties using a complicated formula that was based on the dollar amount of the shopping cart checkout rather than the price of the book. Smashwords is simplifying the rate structure. I remember when, you know, DDD, when we acquired Smashwords, the whole pricing scheme was so confusing to me. And having to talk about it publicly was, I just avoided the topic altogether.
I was like, that's wild. Based on the dollar amount in the shopping cart.
Yeah.
Rather than the price of the book. I've never heard that.
They really wanted to push you they wanted the author to be out there beating the streets and getting people to load up as much as possible. So it was a kind of way to reward you for encouraging people to buy not just your book, but several books. So
interesting.
My understanding.
I
should talk to Mark Coker sometime. What was the deal?
Yeah, because I'm like, why would you buy three of the same ebook or something, you know, I guess. Or if you have backlist, I guess, like buy all 79.
Yeah, it wasn't about that. You know, if you had multiple titles, like if somebody went and bought like all 13 Kotler books, you know, I'd make a better rate or something. But I don't remember. I could be completely off base with all that. I just remember it was very confusing, and so I never talked about it.
Yeah, so Smashwords... is that like, do you buy direct from them or are they all the places? I don't.
Yeah. So no. Okay. So Smashwords was effectively the first version of what Draft to Digital is. But it also had its own retail storefront. So when Draft to Digital took on Smashwords, they've spent a year or two kind of reconfiguring that whole platform, bringing everything over to the D2D side for the authors, but keeping the ebook retail side. So and I assume they're still planning to expand on all that. But the so now Smashwords is effectively just the retail store. You as an author, you would go in, but you'd be going through Draft to Digital to get your books distributed. So you can choose it as one of your outlets, or you can choose not to put your books in there. So
Gotcha. So maybe this is an incentive to try to compete with other ebook places like Amazon and Direct and that kind of stuff.
it's good because you're going to make more. I mean, like, 75% is definitely higher than 70%, which is the next best rate I've seen. Amazon pays, I think, 70 for, depending on your price, if you're, I don't remember, but you usually get, like, most places it's like 60%. So it's good. An extra 5%, I'll take it.
Yeah, Amazon does like 35% if you do expanded through them. Otherwise, they do the 70 if you just do them, which the
That's
model,
interesting.
yeah, like the best model to use
You're
is Draft to
exclusive to
Digital on
us,
Amazon.
right? Yeah,
Well,
I would
no, it's
know.
not exclusive. It's
Yeah.
if you just sell through them but don't do the expanded. So then you just do Draft to Digital and do Amazon and you're fine.
That's the better way to do it anyway, frankly. Between me, you, and whoever's listening, there are a lot of retailers that I don't know, don't like Amazon. It's just a weird coincidence, I think. But as soon as they see that a book's being distributed via Amazon, things happen, or things don't happen, depending on what it is you really want out of life. They may not actually, like, bookstores tend to not want to carry books that were distributed through Amazon's print, KDP print. I mean, I've gotten rejection. I only have a couple of books that are in KDP print, but I've gotten rejections from stores when I've tried to submit them. Yeah, I think it's kind of snobbish, frankly, but I can kind of
Well,
understand why.
okay, I'd
I
like to push
understand why.
that a little bit. I mean, it does kind of feel snobby, but if you're a bookstore and you order books and they don't sell, if you order from like traditionally, you can, as far as I understand, and I don't know, I could be completely wrong, but there's like a sellback. But if you do like the Amazon, basically like that print on demand, then there's no sellback.
That's pretty much true for all of them, though. There are only certain like certain printers that offer that, and it's convoluted to get to it. So it's difficult for indie authors to have that as an option anyway. But
Yeah, so I guess maybe that's why it gets a little trickier when you're like trying to go into bookstores if.
I'd noticed this problem too because I work with a lot of like local authors and we try to do events and stuff. And with the local Barnes and Noble, this is more the print topic as opposed to the ebooks that Smashword News is about. But the one of the authors had the expanded distribution for their print books on Amazon, and like only half of them showed up on the Barnes and Noble web store. And it's not that like Barnes and Noble won't buy their books, but because it's not in their system, they can't let you have events there. And they're like, most Barnes and Nobles are super supportive of their local authors. And so the idea there is if you pop it into Draft to Digital and it's on their web store, then they're more willing for you to bring in copies for them to then scan through their checkout system. So that's why I always tell people do Draft to Digital
I do too.
if they're not going to do anything else.
And I get the not like wanting to carry books that are in print on Amazon when you're an indie bookstore and people come in and window shop and then buy stuff in Amazon. I wouldn't carry it either. So I totally get that.
Yeah, that's the other thing, right?
Yeah.
Because
Yeah.
yeah, it's a very complicated thing, I guess. I know it feels frustrating, but I guess like it, I think it's important to kind of understand like all the nuance. But I don't know, maybe that's just how my brain works.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, in summary, Smashwords is giving me a better royalty.
There you go.
So, next up, speaking of money and prices and better in hiking and all of that. Edelweiss price hike roils industry. Edelweiss was steeply has steeply raised prices under new ownership, with some fees jumping to $90 per title and annual costs doubling or tripling, leaving many publishers, especially small presses, unable to list all their books or offer as many digital review copies. Publishers, booksellers, and sales reps warn the hikes could hurt discoverability, reduce access for indie bookstores, and force presses to cut back on marketing, trade shows, and even staff support. The upheaval has sparked calls for alternatives, with platforms like Book Manager, Firebrand, and NetGalley, Asterism, Microcosm, and possibly Ingram exploring or building competing tools. I'm going to confess, I have no idea what Edelweiss is. I've never heard of it.
So it's how you you can look at things in there, but it's how you get digital ARCs to booksellers.
It's similar to NetGalley. It like the two big ones used to be NetGalley, and I thought it was Edelweiss, but I don't know. It's just that you can request, like, so similar to NetGalley, there are some that you can just download to read. So you create an account, and then you can say, you know, I want to read this one. And some are fully open. Others you have to request. And then someone on the publishing end of whoever's managing that book either says, yes, you have permission, or no, you don't. I know that a lot of bookstagrammers used to prefer Edelweiss to NetGalley because it was easier to get approved. Yeah. Like, you didn't have to be a journalist. You didn't, you know, NetGalley has a lot of weird rules that they make you jump through sometimes. Yeah. So that's disappointing.
Yeah. I would think it has to make it harder for indie authors who are paying out of their own pocket to get their titles to booksellers.
I imagine maybe even debuts too, right? Yeah. Like, you don't get a big marketing budget in your contract.
What was the price before? Like, what were they charging before?
I don't know. Like,
that is a good question that I did not research.
I scanned the article, and what I saw, I don't think is what they were charged, because it said something about $20 per title and $10 per backlist title or something.
I think that's right, because I said it was like a steep hike.
Yeah. That is crazy. I mean, I don't know, man. I get the need for a service like this, but I've never used one. Maybe I should, but I don't even use NetGalley for this. Perhaps I should.
Well, it's for reviewers. Like, you don't really review or like influence on like TikTok or Instagram or anything like that. That's who these are for. NetGalley is a little bit more hoity-toity, and they prefer like to booksellers, librarians, and then like actual journalists. So that's who gets the preference on NetGalley. Edelweiss was more obviously, if you have those credentials, you're going to have better luck, but they were more welcoming to just like reviewers and influencers who may not have like a, you know, formal platform to review on.
Me not really using either of those services, but having used Story Origin, I don't know like why I would use those other ones.
Yeah. Story Origin's more like Goodreads, isn't it?
Well, Story Origin has...
Oh no, I'm thinking of StoryGraph.
Yeah, no, Story Origin is basically like a, almost like a book funnel, kind of, except I know for sure that Story Origin has like the review copies where you can make it so people can request and you can approve the request. I don't know if Book Funnel has it, but I'm sure that they have or will do something like that in the future. But like, as an indie author, why wouldn't I just use Story Origin over that? It sounds like it does the exact same thing and like quote unquote credibility, but especially if you're trying to do social media and handling all of that, you can direct people there and it shouldn't make a difference.
Yeah. I guess it's just that, you know, the discoverability, like, I've never heard, like, I've been in the Bookstagram world since, I don't know, like 2015, 2016. And the only two I've ever heard talked about are NetGalley and Edelweiss. Yeah. The only two. You know, like, yes, you can promote and you can talk about these things, but I guess it's just a matter of like getting the people to know that these other things exist and then to create the accounts. And, you know, how many review accounts do you want to juggle? Yeah. Like, it just, there's always alternatives.
And my recollection was that Edelweiss was more tied to indie bookstores and getting them to booksellers. So that's how it's different than story origin.
Yeah, because you can order through Edelweiss. So if you're a bookseller and you're reviewing, you can then directly order. I don't think you can do that through NetGalley. But again, NetGalley was sort of seen more as like the the journalists. And so you wanted to be there because if they happen to just be like perusing, I'm in the mood to read something, what's available now, they might click on your book, they might read it. It's just the discoverability.
See, I use the old school method of just wrapping my book and tying it to a rock, throwing it through their window. That's
Great idea.
No,
What a
that's where
that
I've had the
explains
biggest
a
success.
lot.
This is not advice.
No, it's advice from Kevin. We can clearly say this was advice from Kevin
So Kevin
Tomlinson.
endorsed activity. And speaking of that activity, that ties into our next story. What is the word of the year? What words did various dictionaries pick as the word of the year? Cambridge picked parasocial as its word of the year, citing its move from academic term to a mainstream way of describing one-sided relationships with influencers and celebrities. Oxford chose rage bait due to rising online manipulation, attention hacking, and digital fatigue. Usage has tripled in the past year. Dictionary.com went viral with 67, a number they.
6 7.
Yeah, you know where we're going. No, it went viral with 67, a number that surged in searches for no meaningful reason, capturing the absurdity of internet-driven language trends. And finally, Collins went with vibe coding, meaning using AI to write computer code from a natural language prompt rather than writing it manually.
Can I just point out that I love Kevin, that you have no idea what 6 7 is and you called it 67.
Oh, is it 6-7?
It
I
is
read
six
it.
seven.
Okay, I have no idea.
I love it. I love that that viral trend has not infected your brain.
Well, I'm somewhat immune to viral trends because I don't pay any attention to what you people talk about.
But they said for no meaningful reason. Now, I thought it was from a song that then got tied to a basketball player that then went viral. Or is that totally wrong? It's just 6 7 for no reason.
Let it be. The more you explain it, the worse it is.
The more you explain it, the worse it is. All right.
I don't know how I feel about like choosing things like that as like the word of the year. Like, perhaps I am just of a certain age, but I definitely feel like the dictionary should be a place where you go to, I don't know, understand things and like it should be grounded in some sort of truth. I don't know how I feel about
I don't know. I kind of love parasocial and rage bait. I think
Well,
those are
yeah.
great words that I
I
want
think
to
those
use
ones are
more.
good.
Well, rage bait's two words. So is vibe coding.
Fair.
It's
Thank you.
fine. At
Fair.
least put a dash in there if you're going to try
Oh,
to.
I saw Times's word of the year was AI slop, which is also two words. So
Yeah.
there you go.
I guess I just don't. It's fine. They're fine words.
You just call it phrase of the year or term of the year or something like that.
Yeah. But they're
It's
all internet related, so
yeah, very much so.
All right. That's
okay.
it for the
Fall
news.
of civilization.
You have a story. Share it with the world. Ingram Spark offers everything you need to publish, promote, sell, and print your book. Reach millions of readers worldwide with powerful tools created for independent authors. Get started for free at ingramspark.com/learn more.
Up this week, it's Mark Tavani. Mark started his publishing career with Ballantine Books and spent more than 23 years with Penguin Random House, Phantom, Del Rey, and Putnam. He edited bestsellers and award winners, including Jim Abbott, Steve Barry, CJ Box, Justin Cronin, Jeffrey Deaver, the list goes on, R.L. Stine. He joined the David Black Literary Agency, where he represents both fiction and nonfiction. So here he is, Mark Devani. Okay, Mark, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. It's great to be with you.
Yeah, I really appreciate you coming on and sharing your experience with our audience. And I would love to start at the beginning. How did you get started in publishing? What motivated you to get into this business?
Absolutely. It was centuries ago, but I went to the University of Pittsburgh, where I majored in creative writing. So my degree was actually in fiction. And then my nonfiction, I was on a school newspaper and took some classes in that space. So both were important to me. And when I was after, so when I was graduating, I was trying to figure out which direction I wanted to go in. I considered getting an MFA, a couple other things. But ultimately, I was able to get an informational interview in publishing that turned into an offer to be an editorial assistant at Penguin Random House before it was Penguin Random House. This was just Random House. And I took a job as an editorial assistant for a great editor. And I was there with that company. That was Ballantine, which then became Ballantine and Random House, which then became Bantam. So all these groups were kind of merging. And I was there for all of that. And I was with that group for about 16 years, I think. And in that time, I got to go from editorial assistant to editor. And I really got to start building my list. And then I had a number of authors in different categories that I was working with. And it was very, very, it was great. It was a great experience being there. And then I moved at a certain point to another imprint within the company. So I moved to G.P. Putnam's Sons, and I was there for about 7 years. Then 2 years ago, I made a move to the other side of the business, and I went from being an editor to being an agent. So now I'm a literary agent with the David Black Agency, and that's where I'm at.
Yeah, so that's so interesting. So if I did my math right, you did 23 years as an editor. What prompted the move to become an agent? What was interesting about that to you?
Yeah, so in so 2023 was a complicated year in publishing in
Yes, it
that
was.
Random House had acquired Simon and Schuster until the Department of Justice said they didn't. And after they didn't, I can't draw any straight lines between anything. All I know is that in the wake of that, there had to be some changes, and there were layoffs at Penguin Random House. That included me. So suddenly here I was not an editor, and I had to figure out what I wanted to do. And I took a few months to really think about it. And my natural instinct at first was just find the best editing job and just do it, right? And I really thought I would. But the more I thought about it, the more I thought, well, this is it. This is kind of the one chance I get to do this a different way if I ever want to, right? And I had a lot of conversations with a lot of people, including David Black, who is the founder of the David Black Agency. And it just became clear to me over those few months that I did want to try something different. And there were a couple reasons why I chose what I chose. One was that I wanted to be 100% in the author's corner. An editor has a really interesting position. I loved being a book editor. And the thing about being a book editor is that you are the person in the middle. Right, you care very much about the author and their work, but you are very loyal to the house that you work for, and you're always kind of like playing the middle between the two. And as an agent, there's no way around it. You are the author's person. You need to be, and that's not only kind of a moral responsibility, it's a fiduciary responsibility, right? You really have to be in their corner. So that was appealing to me. Also, I wanted the chance to work on as broad a list as possible. And as an editor, and this is something that is different house to house, but as an editor, you're generally given a mandate. There's a kind of a set of books that you are asked to work on by the house. It could be one type of fiction, it could be one type of nonfiction, it could even be a little of both, but there's still limitations. The house expects you to work within certain spaces. And as an agent, you don't have that same, oversight, right? Like you really are in a position where if you believe in something and if you and the author are on the same page about what to do with it, you can take it on. So there's a lot more room to be experimental and to try things. And that was really appealing. And then finally, I think that, it was very appealing to me to be in a position where I could be as entrepreneurial as possible. Just, come up with new ideas and say, maybe I can go in this direction. Maybe I could meet these people. Maybe I could partner with this person. And I felt like as an agent, there was just more opportunity for that. So those were the kind of three things that I really ended up focusing on as I made the decision to move to the other side of the desk.
Yeah, I love that you decided to stick with publishing and books and authors. You couldn't get out of this business.
That's right. I mean, and I thought about it, right? I mean, given that moment, I thought about it. But, one of the main, I mean, I love books. I think authors are fascinating, but also I think the work of being in publishing, as hard as it is, as maddening as it sometimes is, and however many times the media will tell you, this is the end of the road and books are done for, it's life-affirming work. To work on books and to put them out there into the world, it is life-affirming work, and that matters. So, yeah, I couldn't quit it.
Yeah, I wholeheartedly agree with all of that. So I'm curious, like you said, when you're an editor, you have some flexibility, but the publishing house really tells you this is what we're working on. As an agent, do you find your taste is the same, or what kind of things are you finding yourself interested in?
So much broader. It
Yeah.
really is. I was always an editor who worked on both fiction and nonfiction. So I had a relatively broad list for an editor. But understandably, when publishers hire an editor, they have an idea of like, well, look, we're trying to be a very complete list as a whole, but we don't need everybody doing everything. We want people to be experts in their spaces, right? So I get it. But as an editor, I found that it was getting more narrow over time for editors, not the other way around. And maybe that's different experience for other editors. I mean, I really can't speak for other people, but my what I saw was more specialization. And I get it, but for me, the thing that powers me as a publishing person is curiosity. That's the number one thing that gives me energy. And the narrower my list got, the less that was satisfied. So, as an agent, I set out very intentionally to work on a pretty wide range of things. Now, that doesn't mean everything. There are definitely things I don't do and I can't do. I'm not qualified to do. I don't represent children's books. I don't even do middle grade or YA. I don't represent culinary, though my agency happens to be very, very good at that. I'm not the person. I don't do reference books. I mean, there's just a number of things you could be in that I'm not in. So it's not that I do everything by any means, but I definitely like to work on both fiction and nonfiction. And there are a number of categories that, as an editor, weren't seen as categories of mine that I'm able to work in. So a really good example is I'm very interested as a reader and a person in books that are that illuminate difficult and important topics. And as an editor, especially in the last years of my being an editor, that really just wasn't a space I was asked to be in, right? So it was books I was reading for pleasure. It was a category I was very interested in the progress of, but it wasn't something that I would be getting submissions for. And now, as an agent, I love finding an expert in a field who has, an absolutely unique angle on an important topic. I love finding an academic who has a trade book in them. I love, finding a topic and then going on the hunt to find the writer who's destined to write it. So all of that is really appealing to me, and it is something that is different from what I was editing. So yeah, so in general, my list is broader in a number of ways that I really enjoy.
Yeah, so you do nonfiction and fiction. So you said you really like someone who is kind of an expert. Is that true in your fiction too, or is that more on the nonfiction side?
So the expert idea would definitely be more the nonfiction side.
Yeah.
On the fiction side, you could be an expert who's bringing us into a world. That's definitely a way fiction can be appealing. But in fiction, I'm generally looking for somebody who they have a great concept, right? They have a big idea, but they've married that big idea to character, voice, and structure that really lights me up as a reader. Sometimes somebody's more one thing than the other, like somebody's more of a voice person than they are a plot person, sometimes vice versa. But in any case, I really feel like it's that alchemy of bringing together a very cool concept with execution that really distinguishes a book in a pretty crowded fiction market. So I think those are the things on the fiction side. On the nonfiction side, expertise is one thing for sure. Sometimes I'm talking to journalists who they're not the expert on the topic, but they're like the explorer who can go in and find all the experts, and they can do these great interviews. So I love working with journalists. And then, you know, sometimes it's more personal on the nonfiction side, and it can be, you know, memoir, where somebody's not an expert and they're not exactly a journalist either, but they have a story to tell of their own experience. So it could be any of those.
Yeah, I love that. So like you said, the market is pretty crowded. So how do you know, and how can an author know if their book is going to be marketable in that space?
You cannot know, but what you can do is you can be really honest with yourself about what the pitch is, right? I think sometimes one of the toughest things to work through with an author is when they're very passionate about an idea and you say, I believe you. And maybe if I read every word of it, I would love it. But before we get there, what is it? Like, where does it fit? Right. And there are times where authors kind of push back and they don't want to pitch their book. Like, they don't want to market it. Either because that's not their skill set, or maybe they don't like the feeling of turning their book into something that's being marketed. And I get it. But if your goal is commercial success, which it doesn't have to be, Emily Dickinson didn't care, so not everybody cares. But if you want commercial success, I think it is really important that early in the process, the author be honest with themselves about, there could be a market. I see a market potentially for this book. And here's how I think my book fits into it. Here's what's unique about my book, but also here's what my book has in common with books that work. Because it is, really importantly, it is that balance of something we know. So it's familiar enough that you have reason to think people could buy it, but also distinct enough that it can stand out. Now, I absolutely would say there has to be room always in the literary marketplace for books that don't have good comparable titles. You need authors doing things that are new, right? If we get rid of that, it's just not worth it. So there are those books. But for most books, you're positioning yourself in a way where you're saying, well, I'm like this book and this book and this book in these ways, but here's what I think is distinct about my work. Mm-hmm. And if you can't find that messaging, you're making it harder for your book to find its home, right? So that is, you can never know if the book is marketable, or at least you can't know if editors will agree. But you should think through how your book can be pitched so that an editor can see it. You know, one of the important things that authors need to know is that editors at publishing houses get so many submissions. Doesn't matter if they're fiction or nonfiction or both, they are getting so many, I mean, hundreds and hundreds a year for many of these editors. Mm-hmm. So when you think that they're getting well more than one a day for a calendar year, and when you think that they might buy 10 books that year, you start to get a sense of how low the rate is, right? And that's the space you're fighting for as an author. So I do think you want to do the work of thinking honestly about where your book could fit in the market and why an editor might believe in it. And sometimes I would say an author could turn to a writing partner or a friend who is a good reader and say, here's what I think it is. And let them come back to you and say, yeah, but what, like, describe, you know, you might need an outside eye who's objective to help you place the book. That's worth doing. Anyway, so that's how I think about that.
Yeah, I really like what you said at the beginning of that. Because where this business gets weird is that it's art, but then we're making it a product. Mm-hmm. So I think sometimes you have to really think, like, do you just want it to be art, which is fine? Or do you want it to be a product? Because if you want it to be a product, then you have to be open to other people coming in, taking your emotions out of it, all of those type of things.
Also, I would say you're totally right. And I would say, because self-publishing is such a genuine option today, if you decide as an author, you know, I don't want to do that, I don't want to compromise my product, then don't. But the flip side will be that you will take on the responsibility and maybe the financial costs of putting that book in motion. Can you self-publish? Can you hire somebody to do a book cover? Can you hire somebody to narrate? In the age of AI, you might even be open to those you know, possibilities of kind of working with, you know, some version of AI to do some of that for you. That's up to you. But I think that because that's an option, it makes it even more important for the author who is deciding, no, I do want to have a publishing house behind me. I do want commercial success in the way that, you know, the New York Times bestseller list or whatever it is, whatever your metric is. If you want to go that route, then you have to address it directly, and you really have to put your book out there. And I acknowledge it's hard. You know, as an editor, I worked with so many authors who were unbelievably talented authors, but they weren't all equally talented at how to pitch their novel, right? And sometimes, as an editor, I would just be the person who'd be like, "Well, let me help you out there because I'm more objective, right? I love this book, but I'm not the author, and I can talk about it in a way that's more objective." So anyway, I acknowledge it's hard, but I think it's important.
Yeah, I agree. And in that, you know, kind of pitching and getting yourself out there, how important do you think platform is for an author who's hopeful getting into trad publishing?
Yeah. Platform is very, very important. I think there are a number of us that would love for it to be less important, but the truth is, it is important. And so let me talk for a second about why it's important. I think publishers are earnestly working to do the best they can to break out books that they buy and they love. But the machinery of how books sell has changed a lot, even in very recent years, like certainly over the last 25 years while I've been in the industry, but especially in the last 5 or so. And I think consumers, they work differently than they used to. Just as an example, you for a long time you would have these authors who were really big and well established, and they would write maybe a book a year or something like that. And you had this really reliable fan base for some of these big successful authors, and they would come back year after year, and almost the same number of people would buy it every year. That was a really healthy business, right, for the industry, and a really great kind of success for these authors. I think after ebooks really established themselves sometime around 2008, 2009, I think that pattern started to change. And I think younger readers are like, they're not like older readers were, where there's, I think the way they approach it is, I'm not going to buy a book just because I bought the last book. I might, but I might not, because I just might want something new. And I think that that kind of reliable consumer vanished on publishers. And they had to find new ways to appeal to these readers. Things have popped up. Book clubs, you know, like from Oprah to Reese to, you know, Jenna, these book clubs popped up and they have been often very successful. Book Talk took over for a while and there was this and there was that. So there will always be new things, right? You know, we're watching the Romanticy, you know, tidal wave just keep on going for now. So that's new and not everyone saw that coming, right? Audiobooks doing so well. That's a good example. So new things will come up. But at the same time, I think publishers have found it harder to push a book to success. There's a kind of an organic nature now to when a book gets discovered that the publisher doesn't control. All of which is to say that publishers feel less in control of what works now than they used to. So what they're asking for authors to do is to bring to the table something of their own possession that can be a mechanism to reach readers, right? People can say that's unfortunate. They can say it's unfair. You know, it is what it is. Publishers need authors to bring this to the table. Now, this is particularly true in nonfiction. If you are doing, like we were talking about, expert-written nonfiction, for example, there's got to be something there. It isn't possible. Really, almost ever, not never, but rarely is it possible these days for a publisher to just power, you know, an expert-led nonfiction book where the author has no connections or platform to great sales just by way of publicity work or marketing work, right? So they are looking for authors who not only have the idea and can turn in a really good book, but also have connection, direct connection with readers, whether that is through social media, speaking engagements, a newsletter, right? There's a lot of different ways it can happen. But basically, publishers will say, okay, look, I like this, but I'm doing the math in my head of how we're going to move any copies. So what does the author bring to the table? Now, in fiction, if it's there, fantastic. But it's different. I do think there's still room in the fiction world for an author to just have written a great book. That can still happen. Publishers would love for there to be something there that they can lean into to publicize the book. And could they pass on a book they think is quite good just because they can't see how to get it there? Yeah, they could. But I would just say that in nonfiction, the pressure is immense and almost all-encompassing. In fiction, it's really helpful to have it. You might be able to do it without it.
I think that's a great answer. So I'm just curious then, if an author wanted to start building their platform right now, what might be one thing you would suggest for them to get started with?
The most important thing is don't do something you're genuinely not comfortable with. I mean, look, I just mentioned there are these options, right? Even within the realm of social media by itself, if you are not an Instagram person, don't become one. Your discomfort will show and it won't work. So, like, if you're an image person, you love doing a video of yourself while you're taking a walk with the dog and you're talking about a book you just read and you love, great, do it. That's Instagram. That's perfect. Or that's TikTok. Fantastic. But if you're a person who is only comfortable really writing, well, Substack might be your path, right? So first things first, pick the one that actually suits you and your purposes. That's the most important thing. Once you do that, take some notes, look around to people who make it work, and if you can, reach out to them. I mean, some of these people don't mind. Hey, yeah, here's how I got started, whatever. And if you do get something started, let's say you do a Substack, but at first you've only got 35 people, checking on your work. Okay. Maybe your next step is reach out to somebody with a bigger following, probably not the person with 250,000 followers because they don't need your query, but the person who's got 12,000 followers, maybe they would let you kind of ghost, write, or not a ghost, but like a guest
Guest
write for
blog.
them, for one, right? You show up, some of those people come over to you. Step by step, start building that thing. And the truth is, ideally, you would think about this well ahead of querying, or if not, then well ahead of submission to publishing houses, right? So again, look for what suits you, then work at it for a bit and see if you can catch some fire and get somewhere with it. Unfortunately, it is very, there's no way around it, I think. Any of that is going to be very work intensive. It's labor intensive, right? So you've got to do your best, the best you can to pick your shots and go for them and see if it comes together. And if it doesn't, I think pay attention to that and shift as fast as you can to try it another way. So those are my kind of thoughts about just kind of getting out of the gate with platform.
Yeah, that's great. That's very helpful. And I do think you have to pick what you're comfortable with, because if you're not authentic about it, everyone will see
Every
it.
exactly, everyone will know, and then you won't be the one they tune into, right?
No, exactly. Well, great. This has went by so fast. Just as we are wrapping up here, is there any other advice you would give to emerging writers about craft or navigating publishing or anything at all?
Yeah, I mean, there's three words that just kind of like ring in my head, and the first is and they're all, they all link, but are also kind of opposites of each other. The first is patience. Books generally don't happen fast, neither getting an agent nor getting a publishing house nor writing the book itself. These things take time. The upside to books is that when they work, they can last a long time, right? But so there has to be some kind of patience. On the flip side of that, some kind of urgency, which is to say, look, it's on you, right? This is a self-starter business. There's no way around it. So stay at it. When you have a rough day, like you get something rejected or you just have a bad day of writing or whatever it is, bounce back, coach yourself back to it, keep going. Little by little is the only way there. The other two paradoxes are openness and persistence. So on one hand, listen to the market. Again, if commercial success is your goal, don't fly in the face of the market. You know what I mean? Like, listen to it. You don't have to sell out, but just listen to it. Take notes. Like, okay, this, okay, more, maybe it's more this, maybe it's more that. But on the flip side of that is persistence. If you really believe in what you've written, if you really believe in your ability and your chances of getting there someday and publishing that book, just stick with it. People will say no along the way. Agents will say no. Editors will say no. Reviewers will say no. Bookstores might even say no to carrying your book. It doesn't mean you can't find success ultimately. So the last word is definitely persistence.
JP, I am glad that you are sitting in for JD this week because you're the only one besides JD who also has an agent. So I'm going to ask your advice on all this stuff.
Great.
I have had agents. I just don't currently have an agent.
Oh, there you go. Okay, go
No.
ahead and jump in. So this was interesting because, editors are in the middle between authors and publishing houses, whereas agents can do whatever they want. I like that, he's choosing to work on things that he's interested. What did you think about what he said about fiction? That concept, voice, and structure is kind of the winning combo. That's it, just that tiny task.
A tiny task.
Thank
I
you.
mean, I agree. I think if you can try and dissolve down what you think drives the market and it's something like that, like regardless of what that thing is for you, I think that that's the key. I know that that was super like ambiguous, but like it's the same thing with the three-story method. When you can say that it's conflict, choice, and consequence, when you can say what like the heart of the story is based off of like the theme or something. But when you're able to sort of understand story with a simple phrase, I think it drives your opinion of storytelling and how you can tell better stories.
Yeah, I agree with that. I like 100%. I think, I know that a lot of us read into, what's an agent looking for? Like, what's that magic recipe? But I really think that it's a matter of the same thing that drives a reader, right? Like, voice is the thing that grabs you in the first page, right? You have a voice. It's the thing that you're like, oh, this is interesting. And I know that people think it's the hook, but I disagree. I think that the voice is what immediately grabs you. I think the hook keeps you. And so, it's, yeah, you got to have that voice. And then it's the content matters, right? Do you have enough other stuff to carry you through the story? And then the structure, which is, are you living up to the conventions that a reader expects? If you're a romance author, like, are you giving the romance reader what they want, what they, pick up a romance book to read? It's vague, but it's also sort of not. Like, I don't know. It feels like it makes sense to me that those are like the three things that agents are looking for.
Yeah. Concept is a tough one. When I first started, I always made my books too complicated. I had these big ideas, but it was just like too much. And I really think there's something to paring down your concept to as succinct as you can get it. And if anyone's confused, you have to take something out of it,
I definitely think the one sentence elevator pitch is like really important. Like, if you can't throw out a general, like condense it really into that one word or that one sentence, or like several short sentences, but like that very like almost like original Twitter length tweet.
Yeah. In the film world, they call it a log line.
Yeah.
Summarize what this is in one sentence. And the famous one is for the movie Speed. It's Die Hard on a bus. Yeah. That's what I start every query letter with. This book is Die Hard on a bus.
In space, no one can hear you scream.
Well,
Like you get,
that's a tagline, but yeah.
well,
Yeah.
but still, it captures it. Like, you know what you're getting in. I guess the thing is like, I think sometimes they think like you have to like summarize the entire plot, but you just have to tell the reader or the viewer, here's what you're getting into. And then they're like, I'm
That's
in.
right.
Yeah.
That's
I
right.
mean, that's why I think like TikTok is really good at that. One, it helped me refine my pitch really quickly, and then to be able to realize whether it's working or how to change it based off of how many people are responding to it, and then also being able to do it in person, and watching other people and see how they are pitching a story and how people are responding to it, because you really only get less than 6 seconds to grab somebody and keep them. So I think that that's really important to know your story, or at least know what will draw people into your story.
Yeah.
Well, and I think too, like writers, you know, we tend to be more on the introverted side anyway. And so like, you know, we've all been there, like, you know, oh, what book are you reading? And then you say it and they go, what's it about? And you're just like, and that happens too with a book you're writing, right? Like you're so in it and you know it so intimately that you're just like,
you want to discuss all those little nuances,
right?
That you,
yeah. But that can also cause you to quite kind of freeze up. And so like, if you have like that very snappy thing that you can fall back on, I think that that's, you know, it's always good to have in your back pocket.
I've noticed that with my earliest books, I have a harder time with this, but with my more recent books, I have log lines for pretty much everything.
Yeah.
And it's, I don't know if that's just a function of, you know, maturity in the field. Like, you know, I've done this now for a while, so I think about the books differently.
Yeah.
But yeah, when I try to tell someone like what one of my earliest books is about, that's where I start fumbling.
Yeah. I do. I write it first now and then
pitch
it to other people. And if they go, huh? Then I'm like, okay, that's too complex. But yeah, we've had platform come up a couple times. And I thought what Mark said about it was really interesting, that those reliable consumers have vanished, that will read the same author book after book, like through a whole series, and they're looking for something new, and that publishers are struggling more to push a book to success.
Yeah.
It's become more organic. Thoughts about that?
This does not gel with my experience. Because my readers will read pretty much anything I put out, which is what I cultivated as I grew. And I think
I wonder if it's generational. I don't.
It might be. Yeah. You know, I think the houses, the publishing houses, are really weak when it comes to platform. I don't think they understand it. I think they think they understand it, and that's the most dangerous form of knowledge. You know, but you know, in simplest terms, like your platform is the range of people you can reach directly who are likely to give you a shot and pick up a book. That's your platform. And, you know, people build platforms in a lot of different ways. I'm starting to add some things to mine. Like I'm doing a lot more YouTube stuff and I'm starting to kind of see some interesting things happen there. But that's why owning a mailing list has always been so important, you know, because you talk directly to the consumer, you form a relationship with them. I think what happens a lot of times, I've had a lot of conversations with the traditional publishing world, and they're interesting because their perception of things is so very different from mine, and they're very sure of it. You know, they're and one guy in particular, I had a conversation. He was just expounding on how all this works and how, you know, the mechanics of it and everything. And I'm like, that is just not my experience with it at all. And I would do something entirely different from what you're proposing. So I don't know. It's just I think that the industry is just a little out of touch when it comes to this kind of thing.
Especially with when it comes to like social media, which is where I do most of my stuff. Like I have people who will see a video about another book and then they'll be like, it's a JP book, I'm picking it up. And like, I've seen it the same with other authors who are way more successful than I am. Like they have a large following of people that will pick up any book that they write. And I just, I don't agree, but I think it's just because the where I'm at in this realm of writing.
Well, I wonder if it's because traditional publishing, what they used to do doesn't work. So like putting somebody on the Today Show, because where people are getting their content is so much more fragmented than it used to be. And so social media, I think, is more organic than, you know, what some of the traditional methods of pushing a book have been.
It is. I do think that publishers are very guilty of assuming they're big hitters naturally, that people will just like they're constantly just like, when's that next book coming out? Because I will notice, you know, because I do a lot of reviewing, and so I'm on that side of things. Like, I'll get emails from, you know, different publishing houses that'll have like a list of upcoming titles. And I'm like, oh, I had no idea that person was releasing a new book. Like, no one's talking about it. Like, you just don't hear about it very often. And I think that that's really kind of interesting. Like, they definitely, I don't know what their marketing plan, like John Grisham's last book was sort of an example. I got an email saying it was coming out, but then I didn't really see it talked about a lot.
Yeah, I haven't seen anything about it. You're talking The Widow?
Yeah.
That's the latest one. And I'm like, I've heard nothing about this book.
And I, you know, it's selling well. And I think that, you know, there are those readers who see it on the bookshelf or in the airport and pick it up because it's John Grisham, but I'm not sure that they necessarily like know it's the new one or that people necessarily have it on its on their radar. And I think things like the rise of Kickstarter, like Brandon Sanderson, basically like breaking Matt Dinneman is another example, like just doing phenomenally on Kickstarter. Like the fans are there. I'm just not sure that publishing knows how to communicate to them in a meaningful way.
Yeah. Which is maybe why it's more important now for authors to have their own platform. Mm-hmm.
You should have your own platform. Yeah. Now, I don't care what level of publishing you're in. I don't care if you are, you know, a mild-mannered Kevin Tomlinson, so sweet and precious, or you are a mega bestseller, Stephen King, John Grisham, whatever. The fact that they don't own their own platform is working against them now. And I think it's only going to get worse. But I think the people who are kind of savvy about it, they have, you know, have always look at Patterson. You know, he's been pretty savvy about owning his own platform.
Yes, he's on Substack. He's got his own show. Like he
exactly
does stuff.
So,
you know? So yeah. What's it called? Hungry Dogs, right? Yeah.
I think those guys are going to continue to be the top, and actually probably take over the top slots from some of those who are traditionally known to be, you know, the big bestsellers.
You have to rely on, you know, just outside of like Barnes and Noble is going to put your book on a shelf at the front door and Amazon is going to like, you know, put it on the homepage. Like that obviously is effective. Like it obviously works. But, you know, if you want to develop the loyal reader, I think that communicating directly to the reader is you have to do it. Otherwise, you're sort of just betting on algorithms. And
which is
that's not a
sucker's
good bet.
That is a sucker's bet. I am starting to learn more and more about that as I kind of dip deeper into the YouTube.
It's like the house always wins version of the digital world, right? Like the house is always going to win. You never bet on it.
Yeah. So you have to count cards is what you're
and
saying.
And as soon as you start showing like you're doing well in some way, it comes crashing down on you like the, you know. So yeah, that is just not a stable way to promote things, depending on the algorithm. I mean, using all these tools to kind of funnel everybody back. Unfortunately, everything I do ends up being slow growth. But it does grow. And you know, over the past couple of decades, I've managed to build a pretty significant audience, you know. So it's just taken all this time. But I have to say, like, all the people I knew who were racing out ahead of me, they're all falling behind now. And, you know, I don't want to name any names, but there's some folks in the indie crowd that were doing phenomenal, but with their like Facebook ad strategies and all these things that they were doing, but that was all very quick, flash in the pan kind of growth, and they didn't build a sustained audience. And so now as things taper off and Facebook ads aren't quite as effective as they were, and you know, they're having to spend more to get the same traction. Whereas I continue just slowly growing. I'm the tortoise in this race.
Yeah, I definitely think the algorithm is like, you know, the Greek gods of the modern day, right? Like they're fickle, they're unpredictable. Like you just never know what's going to appease them or make them angry. Like
all based on Algorithmus, the Greek god of influence.
Nice. Yeah,
you can look that up.
I will.
So we've devolved.
Yes. Yeah. In summary, Get yourself a platform.
Get yourself a platform.
Okay. Up next week, it's Megan Minchev. Megan began her social media management agency, Social with Megan, after spending 20 years in marketing communication for various tech software companies, banks, and newspapers. She now works with multiple brands, including Outliers Writing University and various authors. So up next week, it's Megan Minchev. If you'd like to be notified as soon as new episodes publish, make sure you go to writersincpodcast.com and sign up now. We'll see you next episode and have a great week of writing.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Writers Inc. Access the show notes and leave a comment at writersincpodcast.com.